Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
And good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show, History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I am very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at our toll-free number, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me and tell me your views, please. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You will find me on bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as a follow-up to each and every program. Tonight's topic, rediscovering General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. There are moments in life, as in war, where fate dares to test the fabric of our morality as a people in order to rediscover the temerity of our nation once again. And there, to the side, standing tall and still, we have often felt the presence of providence and holy majesty, always ready to soften the blows of our arrogance against each other in our incessant desire to serve what we do not as yet fully understand, but to always pretend that we do, the elusive promise of justice and truth. And in the muck and confusion of war, there will always be men with a moral view to the moment and the cause he is fighting for. You will always have men driven to make a difference in the memory of that fight, and men committed to reminding other men that good leadership can reawaken the hearts of a nation for sustaining the rationale of a civilization from the guile of our own vanity. In short, there will always be Stonewall Jacksons among us. The American Civil War broke out in April of 1861. If you stop for a moment and think about what the event represented, it should be enough to make you pause, to make you wonder about things like hate, evil, goodness, generosity, political causes, patriotism, nationalism, imperialism, democracy, the equality of rights, the equality of laws, of order, of civil stability, discrimination, the ambition of greed, and of lessons learned. The war also makes me think about whether there's any reliable truth to the historical concept of American exceptionalism. Yeah, that's right, exceptionalism. The idea that American democracy as a national experiment is unique to the world. And, of course, with all of the promises that democracy in action has failed to achieve, it certainly begs the question, is America still considered an exception among other democracies in the world today? Has the promise of democracy been durable enough, reliable enough, for the public to continue to trust it in correcting the civil wrongs of the past? How long is American exceptionalism expected to survive before it imminently qualifies for such a coveted and distinguished recognition? 50 years? 75 years? 130 years? What kinds of tests must America further endure before it can truly be considered an exceptional democracy? another Vietnam, more rioting, a linear moral decline, another economic depression, another civil war, perhaps? There were several major causes that led to the war. One of them was the unevenly applied tariff laws in relation to all the import and export activity between the North and the South. In Europe, and in England in particular. Another cause was the unequal distribution of quality lands in the West that was left over for the South, as last defined by the old Missouri Compromise of 1820. A third cause was the issue of states' rights and whether the right of secession, dating back to the days of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, was ever a constitutional right or an institutional privilege to secede. And, of course, the slavery issue, which originally dealt only with the South's use of slaves for sustaining an agrarian economy under feudal conditions, predominantly. We also came to know that slavery, or the slavery issue, later spilled over into a social and moral question regarding the practice of it by Southern planters. But it was the race card in particular that I feel was most exploited by many Northerners because of the nature of its volatility. However, a curiosity that continues to linger with the practice of slavery in the Old South is the degree of cruelty that actually existed in relation to safeguarding the slaves as property units of production. Was the Old South before the war really as cruel as what folklore suggests or makes it out to be? Or was it Northern propaganda in part that further exacerbated that racial situation beyond what many others expected? But standing above the fray stood a man whose conviction to the war was clear. A soldier whose personal commitment to his wife and other fellow Virginians was firm, and a servant to whom his devotion to God always remained unquestioned. General Stonewall Jackson, in a lot of ways, was a gift for us to learn from, as seen with the examples he left behind. My guest tonight is a gentleman who was born in Ireland and attended college in England, worked in the hotel and catering business for a while, and then turned to working the airline business for another 20 years before dedicating his full-time attention to audiobooks and history narratives as a full-time career. Very interesting turn. He then joined the Weider History Group as a retiree nearly 3 years ago. The flag piece for the group is Stonewall Jackson's Genius, and you will find it on the web, www.historynetshop.com. That's www.historynetshop.com. As the chief librarian of the Weider History Group, as well as married with 4 children, how does he find the time to do it? It is with great pleasure that I introduce to all of you a very well-respected authority on the study of Stonewall Jackson. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Declan Gerard King, welcome to the show, Gerard.
Thank you so much, George, and it's a pleasure to be with you this evening to talk about General Stonewall Jackson and the history of this great and wonderful man. I'm thoroughly delighted to be able to do this evening, as this, for me, being an Irishman, was the great privilege where I entered into the history of the Civil War. And with the consequences not only of Stonewall Jackson, I got such a huge overall embracing aspect of the Civil War and how these United States were formed.
Yes.
And I do I do consider it a great privilege.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure. By the way, I have to ask at this point, who is the Dublin narrator?
That actually is the professional title that I actually use in promoting myself for audiobooks, as the case is. And I have been working in that realm, not only within the sense of history, too, but also from the point of view of some drama and Irish narratives as well. I mean, that would be a natural, of course.
Oh, good.
And, you know, it's been an interesting pursuit, definitely.
Good,
indeed.
Good, good. Well, you know, the position, the job that you do is really unique. It sounds very, very interesting. Let me ask you, what is the difference between a regular head librarian that you might find anywhere you go and what you do?
Well, that would be very hard for me to actually compare out there in that sense. But what I will tell you is that when I joined Weider History as an associate to help the librarian there, I had assisted her in cataloging all of our 11,000-plus books into an electronic catalog and was majorly responsible in constructing the shelf orders, etc., so on and so forth. In addition to that, not only do I deal with civil war, as the case is, which has been my main mantra in that sense, but I have dealt considerably, too, with other aspects, World War II, the Great War. I've done a certain amount of Roman history and history throughout the ages as well. So I guess overall I'm sort of getting pretty well all-rounded, as the case is.
Oh, good. That sounds very, very interesting for you. All right. Well, I have an awful lot of questions about a man that seems to be so cryptic in a lot of ways, so fascinating in others, and yet I'm really not sure how many people really have come to know what Stonewall Jackson has represented for the American people, for American society, for the American military, for America in so many ways and at so many different levels. Let me begin, Gerard, asking you several things about his earlier life. What can you tell us about Jackson's early life and the way he was brought up and some of the things that he began to experience, which formed somewhat of an accumulation as to the embodiment of the fascinating man that he ultimately came out to be?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, George, I do note that Thomas Jonathan Jackson was born in Clarksburg, Virginia. Now, keep in mind, Clarksburg, Virginia, it was Virginia at that time. Today it is West Virginia. West Virginia seceded and became a state, I think, in 1863 during the Civil War.
Yes.
And his parents died when he was very early of typhoid fever. So what had happened was he was, in essence, really an orphan, but he was given over to a relative who took care of him for quite a long time. His name was Cummins Jackson, and that gentleman was quite a character, to say the least. He was one heck of a drinker, a huge man, and was given to a lot of generosity in a lot of ways and was very, very he was a very, very firm friend when people
And typhoid fever was very common in those days, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was very, very common in those times. And, of course, keeping in times the civilization at that time didn't have anything of any level of hygiene and living standards that exist today. So it's a total unknown quantity for anybody else to really know what existed at the time.
So he had to deal with his stepfather. And sometimes you just don't get along with stepfathers, right?
Yes, that is probably true to a point, but he grew up with this man, and he was very much influenced by him in quite a number of ways. And when he grew up, as the case is, he went and he decided he was going to be within the military. And at that time, in those early years of West Point, here in the New York area, it was just relatively a process for any young man aspiring towards military leadership to go to West Point. And that's what he had done. And he went to West Point, and following his graduation there, Well, of course, as we know, the Mexican War started, and he was involved in the Mexican War in a number of conflicts, actually, and it was actually during the Mexican War that he learned from the tactics and everything he was taught.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he probably learned a lot from Winfield Scott, didn't he?
He did indeed. He did indeed. And he understood from his experiences there the importance of the high ground as an artillerist in that sense, from the point of view of the cannon fire on the enemy, as the case is.
Well, I mean, if you talk about the high ground strategy, anywhere from Clausewitz to Sun Tzu, any of these any piece of literature you may pick up from the war college, they'll all tell you the incredible strategy that comes with always holding the high ground. But, you know, talking about West Point for just a minute, Gerard, you know, West Point was a location for a lot of the elite people that wanted to focus their lives on the military as a military man for military careers. I don't think Stonewall Jackson was didn't come from an affluent background, but he did manage to go to a very elite location for a military career. So my question is, to what degree would you say that Stonewall Jackson came to be brought up within the aura and environment of a West Point location with a silver spoon?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's very interesting you bring up that point, because actually that is probably one area I haven't really really delved into in a huge amount in that sense. But having spoken with other historians and editors at Weider History, I have had an overall picture of Stonewall Jackson, and to the extent that his life was very, very hard and difficult, because he didn't have parents, and he was brought up in a very, very poor environment. He was very, very persistent as a result of that in his pursuits of what he aspired towards. And that be the case, he did want to get to the point of being involved in the military. And of course, in that era, as we were discussing, the Mexican War was the prominent campaign that was really the outlet for this young man's military abilities.
Right. You know? I've often been wondered about how people are brought up in different time periods. How would you describe his upbringing back then compared to the way people are brought up in today's world?
Oh, we have a saying in Ireland which goes, it's like chalk or it's like cheese. And I personally think that we could use that there in that sense. You know, basically, this man really had nothing. He didn't have any sense of other than just himself going forward. And it was basically pulling himself up by his own boots and going forward. There was nobody there, no influences, or my understanding is there were no influences or anything like that in his life in that sense because of his background. And that I guess he aspired to get into the college and to learn, you know, the military tactics and strategies and history itself too. And
unbelievable. I mean, the way he was brought up on his own like that. I mean, whatever gave him the penchant or that inclination for the military? Do you think that it might have been his relationship with his stepfather that just throughout the years made him feel more and more militant? I mean, where does this penchant perhaps come from?
Well, you know, Jackson was a remarkable man because the nature of where he was born and lived in that part of Virginia at that time, it was a very hard scrabble environment. And he showed a real survivor's instinct throughout his life. He was, as I say, he was orphaned and displaced. And, you know, the thing about it was he was quick. He was very, very quick-witted, and his aspirations, I am assuming, stemmed from that. Now, you know, he was the sort of person, when he went to West Point, that he he had attributes that from his background he brought with him. He was a very kindly man. He was very generous. I mean, this was one of the experiences that happened within West Point, particularly with respect to cadets and that. And he was all, you know, he was just very, very involved with people from that point of view.
Yeah, but you know, go ahead.
I was going to say the actual decision making for him to go that path, I'm not really sure what his exact motivation for it was at that time, other than the fact that he had a hard life and this was the worthy pursuit for him.
You know, that soft part of him that you were talking about, I happen to have caught in a film that I recently saw, which I might recommend. I'm sure you know of the film, but for others out there listening to the show, the film is called Gods and Generals. And Robert Duvall stars in it, and the personification that is made of Stonewall Jackson, you definitely see that side of him that you're bringing out. But would you be able to know or tell me what kind of bad habits did he have as a youngster, or how he did in school, knowing that he was growing up in such adversity with his stepfather and not having his own parents around? And
well, you know, it's interesting to bring that up because I think that in a sense, you know, the environment, again, as I say, he was brought up in, and he persisted to the point that because of the environment and the toughness. Keep in mind, too, there's a point I want to bring up here, which is interesting, Georgian. Keep in mind, that was the Western frontier almost at that time.
That makes sense. Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think when, if I recall, when he was born, the year 1824 was the year that the last wild buffalo was actually killed in that area of Virginia, or as the case may be, West Virginia now. And I'm assuming that the hard environment that he was brought up in contributed to the path that he had aspired to going towards and following the other paths later on to the Institute and that, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, listen, let's take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with Mr. Gerard King and our topic for this evening's show, the rediscovering of General Stonewall Jackson. We'll be right back.
I beat myself outright. It's the only thing that I can do. And everything I see tonight, you know, is gonna remind me of you. 'Cause it's a hard time standing on the corner like a street sign, watching all the people walk away from me, 'cause they all see something I can't see. I'm like a dead man walking, 'cause I've been...
Okay, and we are back with Mr. Gerard King discussing tonight's topic, the rediscovering of General Stonewall Jackson. Gerard, my next question deals with the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, as it is often known to be called. He taught there, and when he taught at VMI, he was known to teach natural and experimental philosophy. What is that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about Stonewall Jackson and VMI, because in VMI, as a teacher, I think it's important, first of all, to point out that he had a severe learning disability, and he did teach a variety of subjects at VMI, and philosophy was one of these, and as were a number of others concerning strategies and military as well. But, you know, the thing about Stonewall Jackson is that he was very, very, how would I say, he had to do everything by rote, and his philosophy was the same. He was not a sort of a person who was given to being very anecdotal, or he couldn't emphasize points with any elaboration or, you know, personal inputs or anything like that.
Very interesting, because I had no idea that he had a learning disability. That is a real interesting insight. Wow.
Mm-hmm. He did, and he trained his young men at the Institute in this way, and to the point that, giving for example, like he were getting to a point, and a student would come up and ask him to elaborate and perhaps expand on the item, etc., like that. Well, basically, what he did was he went back a few sections on what he had taught, and he went right through it again and continued on.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow.
Yes.
You know, I know he was a very effective professor dealing with, in particular, artillery tactics. Would you be able to elaborate on that a little bit more in terms of how his talent in tactics, artillery tactics in particular, manifested, say, for example, in the First Battle of Bull Run or Manassas Junction?
Well, I guess at Manassas Junction there, at that first battle there, he drew from his experiences, as I say, from the Mexican War, where he had through his experience found out the high ground was the important. And when he got to the field and Barnard B. and the others were, so to speak, fleeing, or they were being routed, as the case may be, he came forward and he stood on the high ground. And basically everyone was saying, stand behind Jackson, stand behind Stonewall Jackson. And, of course, this is where the name came about.
The name, of course, Stonewall. Yeah, look at him. He's standing there like a stone wall. Exactly.
Exactly. And the artillery followed there from that point of view. And, of course, the whole battle turned at that point in time.
He was a bit of an eccentric, though, wasn't he?
Very much so. Very much so. Very eccentric gentleman.
Could you give some examples as to his eccentricity? I think that one of them, he would teach with his arm extended upward because he felt that he had uneven extremities or something like that.
Correct. That is very, very true. He used to, even in the field, he used to go and he used to raise his hand, his right hand towards heaven, as the case may be, and he would hold it there as, so to speak, as if one were stopping the column of the group, as the case may be, but he wasn't. He was just riding along and he was holding it up. And he was asked by one of his officers, why does he do this? Yeah. And his basic answer was, well, the reason I do this is that one arm is shorter than the other. And as a consequence, I use it so that the blood will continue and go down to the other arm.
Wow. <Yeah. laughs> You know, Gerard, one of the other things that just seems to stand out so incredibly about this man is his degree of courage in the battlefield. And so my next question to you is, was his courage in the battlefield a manifestation of insanity? Or was it a manifestation of just raw courage because he had this raw trust in God and his fate and his destiny in this life to do what he was meant to do?
Well, I personally believe that that is the second reason that you have just stated. There's the reason why. He had an enormously strong belief in God. He was a Presbyterian by faith, as the case may be. He lived his life extremely hard, even within his marriage. He was insistent at a specific time of day to have prayers each and every time. At a specific time. I mean, he had this structure in his life which he continually used. And in addition to that, when he was in the field, there were many times that he left the camp, as the case is, and he went to the woods because he had to kneel down and he had to pray before the God, his own God, as the case is. He personally believed that his Lord was protecting him from anything and everything that will happen in battle. He was asked once about this, and the comment he made was, he says, I personally believe that I have to be ready at any time, he said. He says, I am as safe in my bed as I am in battle, as the case is. In other words, whether he be sleeping in bed or whether the bullets and the cannon were flying past him in battle, that was his belief. His belief was so strong in God.
Such incredible faith, That's yeah, well, boy, I mean, you know, when you think about religion and people's faiths nowadays, I mean, this man stands as an anachronism, without a doubt. Gerard, let me get back to tactics here for just a moment. Yes. He was quite fond of training and attacking with a bayonet in particular. Now, at that time, of course, you had your rifles, and they shot circular lead bullets, and so I mean, you could have kept your distance and shot, but yet he had this affinity to train, always train, attacking with the bayonet. What was it about the bayonet and that close combat to combat contact?
I think really the thing behind that, the fact that he, I won't say resorted to the bayonet, but the bayonet was the resort, the real resort of battle in the sense for him. He was a man who had a great deal of in his own ferocity, but his own ferocity, when I say that, was manifested around the fact of his faith. So he became a strong leader with all those, with all those virtues within him. But finally, I think when he resorted to the bayonet, he always wanted his troops and all his men to have that ability of being able to fight to the end. And this was how he treated his men. He may have treated them wonderfully as men, which he has always done, but he pushed them so hard.
Yeah.
He pushed them so hard. And many of them, as we know, thousands of men died under these generals. And in this instance, too, the bayonet was one of the key weapons that was part and parcel of the military structure at that time.
Yeah. Well, it sounds very much like the 20th century Patton.
Yes, to a point. Patton was a real protege of Stonewall Jackson, as were a number of other generals during the Second World War
as well. Exactly. You're absolutely right, because here, even the Nazis, Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox from the Africa Corps, studied General Lee's tactics and Stonewall Jackson's as well. And a lot of people may not know this, but it happens to be true.
Yeah, that's very, very true, General Patton, Rommel, and I would say General Douglas MacArthur and his following substitute, General Ridgway, were all proteges of Stonewall Jackson and ascribed towards his tactics in their own warfare.
Right, right. And, no, absolutely. Gerard, there was a book out there. It's not necessarily new, but it is a classic. It was given to me by a very, very good and close friend of mine called Attack and Die. The book was written by two gentlemen by the name of Grady McWinney and Perry Jameson. It's called Attack and Die, Civil War Military Tactics and the Southern Heritage. I read this book, and it was a fascinating read because one of the main lines of argument that the book makes is that Southerners were known to attack with a blinding passion. It wasn't like the Northern factory workers where they attacked in a more objective or what McClellan trained them to do and drill and drill and drill without enough battle experience in attacking, as we all know about McClellan. But in Attack and Die, this book is suggesting that the Southerners went beyond their training and drill and into this blinding passion for the fight. So my question to you, as a person that has so closely studied this, is did a lot of this simply rub off from Stonewall Jackson in his almost religious or spiritual passion for the fight?
That is a very, very good, very, very good analysis of the actual situation there, because I think that real passion that he had for the fight was what really pushed his men so hard. And his men were highly devoted to him, as I had mentioned beforehand, because he had this really enormous relationship with where he took care of all of his men personally. Not so much the officers in that sense. They were his officers, in the case maybe they were there for the orders that he gave. But his men he kept really close to him in that sense. And the important thing to consider is that when he pushed his men so hard, he expected the results.
Yes.
And this goes back
to
what you talk about, the bayonet, et cetera, like that. You had to have every form of warfare that you knew right available to you. Because, you know, the thing about it was you had to win. You had to defeat the enemy. And this was what he was. And in a sense, too, he was very, very merciless. When I say he was very, very merciless, he would... Well, let me put it to you this way. There were many of his own men, for whatever reason, were executed under his hand for those reasons. And they were set as examples.
For deserters and so forth. Absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was actually saying that with respect to this persistence and this sense of real passion, I mean, and it's unusual to see this, but when you see it in history, et cetera, like that, it sets a perfect example for the future generations that they ascribe to this. How did this man do this? How did this man defeat these people with such smaller numbers, but it was through his tactics and his persistence that he did it, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Very, very interesting, absolutely. Gerard, I wanted to ask you something with a little bit of a different turn, more like a political question. The idea of secession during his time, as you know, was huge, and General Lee was not a fan of secession at all. He never really liked the idea of leaving the Union, breaking up the Union into two parts. But his devotion and his love to Virginia was much, much stronger. And, of course, Stonewall Jackson was no exception to that rule. He had his love for Virginia just as deeply as General Lee had it. So what I wanted to ask you is his idea of secession. He didn't like it at first. What might be some of the reasons for his dislike of secession?
Well, I personally believe that Stonewall Jackson, because of his faith and his background, as much as Lee did too as well, loved Virginia. And probably ascribed to the same beliefs and philosophies, I'm sure, as General Lee did. Anyway, I myself, in my own research and information, have not really covered a lot of his own political leanings from that point of view. But I do tend to think that Stonewall Jackson himself, because of his faith and his background, was the sort of person who really... If I may use it, a sense of fairness.
Yeah.
A sense of fairness in society. And, of course, at that time, it was a divided country, as the case is.
Yes, it was. And I suspect that there was this sense of duty that, although he disagreed with the idea of secession, yet his devotion and his duty called for something much bigger, much taller.
Exactly. He was a soldier, and he always ascribed to the first primary rule of being a soldier, which was duty. He was duty bound.
Yeah.
And that duty to him meant was that he had to be obedient. And being obedient to his general, General Lee, was he did all of everything that General Lee asked. And not only that, he did more, because Lee gave Stonewall Jackson the carte blanche to go ahead and make whatever those decisions were that he thought were best for the troops and the campaign at that time.
Yes, absolutely. And because of his sense of duty and his courage, I'm wondering now it dovetails with what I want to ask you regarding his death. But we know that he was killed by friendly fire. But how would you describe his approach to death? Did he take it with as much courage and conviction and faith and resolve and simply resigned himself to his fate with the same courage as and gallantry that he took the battlefield?
Well, as we probably know, what happened with Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville, when he went into the dark and forward of the troops, the skirmish line, etc., like that, the misinterpretation by the North Carolinian regiment at that time was that these were Union troops, and this is where all this fire came about. And the numbers of Stonewall's party who were forward of the troops were actually killed too. As wow. Some were injured. Now, as had happened at that time, they said, cease your fire. But the North Carolinians had heard that ruse beforehand, so consequently they just started firing more so. Now, what had happened with Stonewall was he was hit in the shoulder and he was hit in the arm. And he was taken from the field, and during the time when they were taking him from the field, if I may call it the bier or the stretcher he was on, was actually dropped, and he was in terrible, terrible pain. However, when they brought him forward, they brought him to the location they brought him to was I don't have it exactly in front of me as the case is at this time, but he went and he was treated. After his initial treatment by his doctor, Dr. McGuire, who had to make that decision at the time and say, because of the seriousness of this injury, your arm has to be amputated and taken off.
Yes.
And in those days, as we know, they didn't have any anesthetic or anything like that. They were basically given a huge dose of whiskey and a knife which was wound with a whole bunch of linen and was put in their mouth, so that they could grasp it in their mouth, and they went through what they went through. Interestingly enough, the Stonewall Jackson's arm is not with Stonewall Jackson. It's buried in a separate location, believe it or not.
Oh, really? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yes. It is not buried with Stonewall Jackson. Stonewall Jackson, I believe, is interred in his hometown of Lexington in Southern Virginia.
Wow.
But, his arm is in another location, and I believe it's not far away from where he actually died. When Stonewall Jackson died, he had been about 8 days injured, and his injuries came. He was making some degree of recovery, and he was to a point, I would say, even delirious. He even made a few interesting, very interesting quotes here, which I will give to you. He said, for example, battlefield commands. He said, "Order AP Hill to prepare for action.
Wow.
Pass the infantry to the front."
Wow.
And, you know, then after a while, he just calmed down, and it was like he knew that his God was calling him.
He was reliving a lot of key moments probably in his life.
Perhaps he was, etc., like that. In those final hours, these sort of memories come, I'm sure, to all, etc., who are in these in this position, etc.
Now, however, Gerard, go ahead.
I was actually going to say his final words were, "Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees." And then he died.
Yeah.
And
we have about just under 5 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you with such a an incredible military figure, how would Jackson fit into the 21st century?
Well, I personally believe, from my point of view, I think Jackson obviously his sense of being, his learning, his faith, etc., would be those key components which he would have for his actions today in this century, be it that he would be able to, we'll assume, orient himself towards modern warfare. However, the nature of warfare today has changed so dramatically, as it is changing all the time.
Yes, yes.
So I believe that really when I look at Stonewall Jackson and I look at all these other great men of history who have been through the Civil War, etc., and have given us what we have given, we have to cherish those memories and embrace them and realize the importance of what these men and their sacrifice has given to us. And you know, as a person who's, I guess you could call me a history buff, not a historian. I wouldn't use that term. But from that point of view, I do realize that, and I see it in the words and in the leadership and direction that these men had.
Yeah. Well, anyways, that's about all the time that we have for now. Boy, we have to do this show again because there are so many other things that I would like to ask you about such a fascinating person like Stonewall Jackson. Mr. King, sir, I hope to have you back on the show once again. Thank you, Gerard, for being a guest on the show and leaving us with a new insight on General Stonewall Jackson, the American Civil War, a figure very much appreciated among historians worldwide as well as in the world of academia.
And thank you so much.
You're very welcome, sir. And now we've come to the final part of our show where I wish to leave all of you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. What is it about war that, for some, bring out the most extraordinary quality in people from the most ordinary of men? General Thomas Jackson, religious by birth, spiritual by choice, and faithful by conviction. How is it that a man of such humble beginnings could know how to use the darkness of war as a means of emerging as a representation for men to follow? Jackson brought us to understand that there can be a clarity to conflict and a devotion to courage and principle, the very stuff that people look for in the folklore often found among heroes, which is nothing less than extraordinary when considering how his leadership came to inspire so many generations to be better than what they are and to do more with what they have when deciding to serve their fellow human beings. We need heroes in our lives. Heroes to help model for us how to live better lives, how to treat our families and children with the affection they so much deserve, and how to get through the struggles and adversities of daily living with all the problems and worries that each day brings to us. We need to see a similar leadership today to guide us, a leadership that inspires us to be more than what we are. But we don't see that kind of person anymore. Instead, we're surrounded by mediocrity, filling our days with so much hollow that we become more and more insensitive to each other until we begin to die a little inside with each passing day. Our hope often tells us that there will be others, other leaders to light up our resilience to renaissance from the gray and colorless days of our living. They will come, and we will recognize them for what they will bring to us once again, a lift in the tallness of our lives. But until then, there must be patience in our faith to wait. Join me again next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing all of you a very pleasant evening.